Good morning, everyone, and welcome to Talking Information Center. This is Marianne Kachuk, and I'll be reading today from Newsmax. It is Tuesday, February 17th. Okay, our first article. More ice surges possible as Minnesota drawdown begins, Homan says. Tom Homan, the White House Board of SAR, said he is leaving open the possibility of federal immigration and customs enforcement deployments in other sanctuary cities, even as the administration winds down its enforcement surge in Minnesota. He told CBS Face the Nation that sending agents elsewhere depends on the situation and argued that we need to flood the zone and sanctuary cities with additional agents if local conditions warrant it. Homan remarks came as the Trump administration begins drawing down Operation Metro Surge in the Minneapolis-St. Paul area after more than 2 months of heightened federal enforcement, legal clashes, and sustained protests that intensified following the fatal shootings of two individuals, Renee Good and Alex Pretty, during confrontations with federal immigration officers. At a Minneapolis press conference announcing the end of the surge, Homan said he and President Donald Trump agreed the operation should conclude because cooperation with local officials had improved and enforcement objectives had been met. But he made clear the withdrawal would be gradual and that a small force of federal officers would remain temporarily to protect agents and respond if protesters, or what he called agitators, confront personnel. We'll get back to the original footprint, Homan said, adding that the residual contingent would stay for a short period of time to make sure the coordination of the agreements we have with locals and state law enforcement stay in place. Homan confirmed during his CBS interview that more than 1,000 agents have already left Minnesota and that hundreds more are expected to depart in the coming days, but he declined to specify how many officers would remain, saying only that the continuing presence would be sufficient to ensure officer safety and maintain operational stability. The surge, which at its peak placed roughly 3,000 federal officers in Minnesota, became one of the most controversial immigration enforcement efforts of Trump's second term after the January shooting sparked large demonstrations across Minneapolis and St. Paul and drew national security and federal tactics. Minnesota Governor Tim Walz criticized the operation's impact and expressed skepticism about the administration's broader intentions, saying the deployment inflicted deep damage, generational trauma, economic ruin, and warning that talk of sending agents to other cities risks repeating the turmoil seen in the Twin Cities. Minneapolis Mayor Jacob Frey welcomed the drawdown but urged accountability, saying the city must work to restore trust and stability after months of disruption and emphasizing that Minneapolis will continue to support immigration communities even as federal policies shift. Civil liberties advocates also responded directly to Homan's suggestion of potential future deployments, with the American Civil Liberties Union pointing to polling it conducted with YouGov showing that 53% of voters viewed recent ICE actions unfavorable and 55% support ending mass ICE raids, arguing that public sentiment cuts against expanding aggressive enforcement into additional sanctuary jurisdictions. Homan defended the broader strategy in a CBS interview, saying the Minnesota effort yielded the successful results we came here for, and reiterating that federal immigration laws will be enforced regardless of local sanctuary policies. With the bulk of agents leaving Minnesota, but a small federal contingent still in place, Homan underscored that additional deployments remain possible, saying that if federal officials need to surge resources into another sanctuary city, we will, signaling that the administration's immigration crackdown remains active and the other cities could face similar federal surges depending on conditions on the ground. Trump says he will be involved indirectly in Iran talks. President Donald Trump said on Monday that he would be involved indirectly in talks between Iran and the U.S. over Tehran's nuclear program set to begin on Tuesday in Geneva, adding he believed Tehran wanted to make a deal. I'll be involved in those talks indirectly, and they'll be very important, Trump told reporters aboard Air Force One. Tensions are soaring ahead of the talks, with the U.S. deploying a second aircraft carrier to the Middle East. The U.S. military is preparing for the possibility of a sustained military campaign if the talks do not succeed, U.S. officials have told Reuters. Asked about the prospect for a deal, Trump said Iran sought tough negotiations but learned the consequences of such a hardened stance last summer when the U.S. bombed Iranian nuclear sites. Trump suggested Iranians were motivated this time to negotiate. I don't think they want the consequences of not making a deal, Trump said. Prior to the U.S. joining Israel and striking Iranian nuclear sites in June, Iran-U.S. nuclear talks had stalled over Washington's demand that Tehran forego enrichments on its soil, which the U.S. views as a pathway to an Iranian nuclear weapon. Iran's Civil Defense Organization on Monday held a chemical defense drill in the Pars Special Economic Energy Zone to strengthen preparedness for potential chemical incidences in the energy hub located in southern Iran. Trump, death penalty if Nancy Garthy is killed. President Donald Trump said Monday he will instruct the Justice Department to seek the death penalty if Savannah Guthrie's missing mother is killed. During a brief phone interview with the New York Post, Trump warned that those responsible for the abduction of 84-year-old Nancy Guthrie must release her unharmed or face very, very severe, the most severe, federal consequences. If she is killed, I will be instructing the Department of Justice to seek the death penalty, Trump told the Post, underscoring his administration's hard-line stance on violent crime. Nancy Guthrie, the mother of NBC Today co-host Savannah Guthrie, was abducted from her home outside Tucson, Arizona on February 1st. The case has drawn national attention and prompted a massive multi-agency investigation involving local law enforcement and federal authorities. Trump's comments signal that the White House is prepared to pursue federal charges in the case, which is common in high-profile kidnappings, particularly when interstate activity or federal statutes are involved. Arizona has the death penalty, though executions have been infrequent in recent years. Of the 109 inmates currently on Arizona's death row, many have been there for decades. The state has carried out just 2 executions since 2022, following a nearly 2-year pause ordered by the Democrat-led state government. That pause was lifted in late 2024. At the federal level, the use of capital punishment was significantly curtailed under former President Joe Biden, who commuted the sentences of 37 of the 40 men on federal death row. The Trump administration has signaled its plans to move those inmates to a federal supermax facility to serve out their sentence under strict conditions. Trump has long advocated for tougher penalties in cases involving violent offenders, particularly crimes against children and the elderly. His remarks Monday reinforced his remarks Monday reinforced that message as the investigation into Nancy Guthrie's disappearance continues. Law enforcement officials have not yet announced any arrests, but authorities have released surveillance images that are pursuing multiple leads. Court blocks Park Service's removal of slavery displays. A federal judge on Monday ordered the National Park Service to restore slavery-related displays it removed from the President's House site at Independence National Historical Park in Philadelphia. The judge ruled that the agency likely acted unlawfully and in excess of its authority. U.S. District Judge Cynthia Roof, a George W. Bush appointee, granted Philadelphia's motion for a preliminary injunction requiring the federal government to reinstall 34 educational panels and related video exhibits that referenced slavery and slaves held by President George Washington. The city sued after the National Park Service removed the exhibits on January 22nd. The display detailed the lives of 9 slaves who lived and worked at the president's house, including Oney Judge, who escaped to freedom in 1796. In a sharp-worded 40-page opinion, Roof rejected the government's assertion that it could unilaterally alter the site's historical interpretation, as if the Ministry of Truth in George Orwell's 1984 now existed. This court is now asked to determine whether the federal government has the power it claims to dissemble and disassemble historical truths when it has some domain over historical facts, Roof wrote. It does not. The court found the city has standing to sue, citing decades of cooperative agreements between Philadelphia and the Interior Department governing preservation and interpretation of the park. Under a 1948 federal statute, cooperation agreements for the park must include provisions that no changes or alterations shall be made in the property within the Independence Hall National Historic Site, including its buildings and grounds, except by mutual agreement. Roof concluded that the National Park Service did not seek or obtain the city's agreement before removing the exhibits, despite longstanding contractual and statutory obligations. The removal of the President's House displays invaded this legally protected interest, the judge wrote, finding the city's injury concrete, particularized, and actual. The court also ruled the city is likely to succeed on its claims that the agency's actions were arbitrary and capricious under the Administration Procedure Act. Roof said the agency offered no record evidence that it considered its prior interpretive framework or its own governing foundation document, which identifies the paradox of freedom and slavery, as central to the park's mission. The government cited a March 27, 2025 executive order by President Donald Trump titled Restoring Truth and Sanity to America History, which directed Interior Secretary Doug Burgum to ensure federal monuments do not contain content that inappropriately disparaged America's past or living. The goal was to instead focus on the greatness of the achievements and progress of the American people. But Roof said the executive order required action consistent with applicable law and does not authorize agencies to disregard statutory obligations. Statutory mandates or cooperative agreements. It is not disputed that President Washington owned slaves, the court wrote, rejecting any suggestion that the exhibits were historically inaccurate. Roof also faulted the agency for failing to provide a reasoned explanation for what she described as a sharp turnaround in agency policy. On the separation of powers issue, the judge wrote that Congress specifically limited the authority of the Interior Department and the National Park Service to unilaterally alter or control the park and that the agencies do not have the authority to flout that constitutional directive. In concluding, the city's demonstrated irreparable harm, Roof said, each visitor who does not learn about founding-era slavery at the site receives a false account of this country's history. The injunction requires the government to reinstall all panels, displays, and video exhibits that were previously in place and to prevent further changes absent a mutual written agreement with the city. The order will remain in effect pending further litigation. Newsmax reached out to the Department of Justice and the Interior Department for comment. Roof appeals life sentence in Trump plot. Ryan Roof, who was convicted of attempting to assassinate Donald Trump during the 2024 campaign, has filed an appeal challenging his conviction and his life sentence. A notice filed with the 11th U.S. Circuit Court of Appeals states that Roof intends to contest the verdict and the sentence imposed this month, according to The Hill. A jury found Roof guilty on 5 counts, including attempted assassination of a major presidential candidate, which carries a maximum penalty of life in prison. Prosecutors said Roof spent weeks planning the attack and positioned himself near the 6th hole of Trump's International Golf Club in West Palm Beach, Florida, in September 2024, placing a rifle through vegetation along the course perimeter. Witnesses testified that he was spotted before Trump, who at the time was a former president and would win re-election 2 months later, came into view. Roof fled after a Secret Service agent fired in his direction. He was arrested later on a nearby highway. The Department of Justice sought a life sentence, while Roof requested a 27-year term, arguing that trial errors justified a lesser sentence. Roof represented himself at a trial after asking to dismiss his public defender. He told U.S. District Judge Eileen Cannon that his inability to effectively confront witnesses, use exhibits, or affirmatively introduce impeachment evidence affected the outcome. An attorney who assisted Ruth at sentencing argued that a reduced sentence would still keep him incarcerated into his 80s and allowed access to correctional and mental health treatment. Ruth tried to stab himself with a pen after the verdict was announced. In the appeal filing, attorney Martin Roth argued that letting Ruth represent himself could be grounds for review and cited Cannon's decision not to recuse herself and the court's findings that the offense constituted terrorism. Prosecutors wrote in court filings that Ruth sought to kill Trump cravenly in cold blood and showed no remorse. The Constitution affords citizens many peaceful avenues to oppose or express strong dissent about a presidential candidate. Murder is not one of them, the government said. September 24, 2024 incident occurred 2 months after a separate assassination attempt aimed at Trump at a campaign rally in Butler, Pennsylvania, where the assailant was gunned down by a Secret Service counter-sniper. Trump, loser Newsom's UK energy deal inappropriate. President Donald Trump on Monday blasted California Governor Gavin Newsom over his newly announced clean energy agreement with the UK, calling the deal inappropriate and criticizing the Democrats' environmental record. Trump made the comments in an interview with Politico after Newsom announced a memorandum of understanding with Great Britain to advance clean energy technologies. The UK's got enough trouble without getting involved with Gavin Newsom. Newscom, Trump told Politico, using his nickname for Newsom. Gavin is a loser. Everything he touches turns to garbage. His state has gone to hell and his environmental work is a disaster. Trump added that it was inappropriate for Newsom to enter into such agreements and inappropriate for them to be dealing with him. Newsom, a 2028 Democratic presidential hopeful, met with UK Energy Secretary Ed Miliband in London during a European tour, where the two pledged to collaborate on clean energy projects, including offshore wind, as part of efforts to achieve net zero emissions. Miliband said, Strong international partnerships would expand opportunities for UK businesses and help secure new investments for the country. However, Trump, who has repeatedly criticized wind power and blasted Newsom's leadership of the nation's most populous state, warned that the agreement will ultimately hurt the UK. People are leaving, Trump said of California. The worst thing that the UK can do is get involved with Gavin. If they did to the UK what he did to California, this will not be a very successful venture. The Trump administration withdrew the U.S. from the United Nations Framework Convention on Climate Change this year. Against that backdrop, Newsom delivered a contrasting message to European leaders at last week's Munich Security Conference, telling attendees, "If there's nothing else I can communicate today, Donald Trump is temporary. He'll be gone in 3 years." In a related story, Trump amazed incompetent Newsom eyeing 2028 run. President Donald Trump said he is amazed that California Governor Gavin Newsom is considering a run for the White House, arguing that the Democrat governor's record has left the state poorly managed and vulnerable to criticism on a national stage. "I'm amazed Gavin wants to run for office," Trump told the California Post in a Friday Oval Office interview conducted shortly after his administration had filed a lawsuit against California over its sanctuary policies, accused the state of fraud, and moved to claw back federal funding. Trump repeatedly criticized Newsom's leadership, calling the governor incompetent and saying California is suffering under his administration. "People love the dream of California, but they hate what's happening to them," Trump said, adding that the state needs proper leadership and is not getting it from its current governor. Newsom has emerged as a leading figure among Democrats as the party looks ahead to the 2028 presidential race. According to Real Clear Politics polling averages, Newsom leads the Democratic Party field with 24% support, followed by former Vice President Kamala Harris at 21%, former Transportation Secretary Pete Buttigieg at 11%, and Representative Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez, Democrat for New York, at 8%. Trump predicted that Newsom's tenure as governor would weigh heavily on any presidential campaign, singling out California's high-speed rail project, which was originally designed to connect Los Angeles and San Francisco. Here's the train to nowhere that was supposed to be a simple train that went from San Francisco to Los Angeles, Trump told the California Post. It's the greatest cost runover that I've ever seen. The project, now estimated to cost $135 billion, is the most expensive rail project in U.S. history. Construction was initially slated for completion in 2020, but has been repeatedly delayed. Current projection targets completion around 2030 for a limited Central Valley segment between Bakersfield and Merced, far short of the state's largest population centers. Funding for the project has also been unstable, with billions of dollars in federal support pulled, restored, and withdrawn again over multiple administrations, leaving California taxpayers responsible for keeping the project afloat. Earlier this month, Newsom defended the rail effort during his State of the State address, saying the project was back on track. Speaking of tracks, we're finally laying them, Newsom said, citing more than 60 miles of completed guideway in the Central Valley, land acquisition, and environmental clearance along much of the route. Trump dismissed those claims, saying the project should have been completed long ago. I could have built that thing, and I could have built that thing in 1 year, he said. Trump also described his relationship with Newsom as deteriorating sharply since his first term in office. I used to get along with him, and now it's sort of a hopeless situation, Trump said. They've gone radical left. They're crazy. Newsom, who has increasingly adopted a confrontational national profile, was in Davos, Switzerland this week, attending the World Economic Forum at the same time as Trump, as speculation continues to build over potential 2028 presidential bid. Report: Pentagon threatens to cut off Anthropic in AI safeguards dispute. The Pentagon is considering ending its relationship with artificial intelligence company Anthropic over its insistence on keeping some restrictions on how the U.S. military uses its models, Axios reported on Saturday, citing an administration official. The Pentagon is pushing four AI companies to let the military use their tools for all lawful purposes, including in areas of weapons development, intelligence collection, and battlefield operations. But Anthropic has not agreed to those terms, and the Pentagon is getting fed up after months of negotiations, according to the Axios report. The other companies include OpenAI, Google, and xAI. And Anthropic spokesperson said the company has not discussed the use of its AI model Claude for specific operations with the Pentagon. The spokesperson said conversations with the U.S. government so far had focused on a specific set of usage policy questions, including hard limits around fully autonomous weapons and domestic surveillance, none of which related to current operations. The Pentagon did not immediately respond to Reuters' request for comment. Anthropic's AI model Claude was used in the U.S. military's operation to capture former Venezuelan President Nicolas Maduro, with Claude deployed via Anthropic's partnership with data firm Palantir, the Wall Street Journal reported on Friday. Reuters reported on Wednesday that the Pentagon was pushing top AI companies, including OpenAI and Anthropic, to make their artificial intelligence tools available on classified networks without many of the standard restrictions that companies apply to users. Representative Biggs to Newsmax: Dems used Munich Forum to bash Trump. Representative Sherry Biggs, Republican for South Carolina, told Newsmax on Monday that Democrat leaders who attended the Munich Security Conference embarrassed the U.S. by using the international forum to criticize President Donald Trump rather than focus on global security challenges. The Munich gathering, one of the world's premier security forums, drew dozens of heads of state, with U.S. officials seeking to outline the administration's foreign policy priorities amid the war in Ukraine and debate over NATO spending. Secretary of State Marco Rubio delivered a keynote speech emphasizing the enduring U.S.-Europe partnership, aiming to reassure allies despite tensions over Trump's administration policy directions. However, several Democrat leaders and potential 2028 presidential contenders, including California Governor Gavin Newsom and Representative Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez, Democrat from New York, used their platforms at the conference to critique Trump's foreign policy. Biggs, a member of the Foreign House Affairs Committee, criticized Ocasio-Cortez over her comments about Taiwan. When I heard that clip, all I could think was, we have a saying in the South, and it's bless her heart, because that was an absolute embarrassment, Biggs said in an interview with National Report on Monday. I honestly felt sorry for her, and all I could think about was, God forbid if this person was in charge one day, she added. I know right now she doesn't speak for me, and she doesn't speak for America, and she is not in a position of leadership, Biggs added, and I'm very grateful that we have a President Trump as our commander-in-chief. Asked whether Munich was the appropriate setting for attacks on the president, Biggs said, absolutely not. She added, it's just showing that the Democrats are failing their policies. They have nothing to go on, and they cannot stand the fact that this administration, President Trump, is moving forward. Biggs praised Trump for growing our economy. He's taking care of America. He's putting our citizens first, and they can't stand it. So all they have to go on is to bash him and to cause this chaos. In contrast, Biggs praised Rubio's address, which emphasized renewed American strength and partnership with European allies, and received a standing ovation from attendees. Well, I think he speaks for America, and he speaks for this administration and moving forward, Biggs said. And it doesn't just benefit the U.S. Everyone will benefit. She added, it shows strength and unity. Biggs also addressed the Justice Department's recent release of documents related to convicted sex offender Jeffrey Epstein, which has prompted criticism from some lawmakers over redactions and question about completeness. Well, I'm grateful that they have released that information, Biggs said. I believe in truth and I believe in transparency. She argued that if the Biden administration had possessed information implicating President Donald Trump or members of his administration, it would have been made public earlier. If President Biden had any information that would have pointed at fault to President Trump or anyone affiliated with his administration, don't you believe that the information would have come out long before President Trump took office? Biggs said. I feel confident that this information is going to reveal that, and I'm glad that it's out and available and want to move forward, she added. This is just a distraction, in my opinion, Biggs said, noting that names were released, but that it doesn't indicate any wrongdoing. Greenwood to Newsmax, Trump among the best presidents we've ever had. Country music singer and entertainer Lee Greenwood told Newsmax that President Donald Trump is among the best presidents we've ever had. Greenwood told Ed Henry, The Big Take, on Monday that I think he's one of the best presidents we've ever had because he has the gumption to make change. It's really tough. Greenwood said the ballroom construction at the White House is a good example. Let's just talk about the extension of the White House, for instance. How many presidents would have had the audacity to go ahead and make that kind of construction? It's something we needed. So the president went way out, and it cost the taxpayers nothing, he said. The extra building to the White House, a beautiful ballroom. It'll be a presentation we're going to be proud of, he said. The entertainer said his famous song, God Bless the USA, which is played at Trump events, has stood the test of time. You know, I wrote that song to be for all time. I didn't put any dates on it on purpose, and it has surprised me, actually, that it's been now four generations because I wrote it in 1983. That's a long time, he said. That's 1983. And as we move forward in time, the president certainly has put his mark on my song, and I'm proud of it. Greenwood also added that his latest publishing venture, the God Bless the USA Bible, will be part of his participation with Trump for the nation's 250th anniversary celebration in July. Civil rights leader Reverend Jesse Jackson dies at 84. The Reverend Jesse L. Jackson, a protege of the Reverend Martin Luther King Jr. and two-time presidential candidate who led the civil rights movement for decades after the Reverend leader's assassination, died Tuesday. He was 84. His daughter, Santita Jackson, confirmed that her father died at home, surrounded by family. As a young organizer in Chicago, Jackson was called to meet with King at the Lorraine Motel in Memphis shortly before King was killed, and he publicly positioned himself thereafter as King's successor. Jackson led a lifetime of crusades in the United States and abroad, advocating for the poor and underrepresented on issues from voting rights and job opportunities to education and health care. He scored diplomatic victories with world leaders, and through his Rainbow Push Coalition, he channeled cries for black pride and self-determination into corporate boardrooms, pressuring executives to make America a more open and equitable society. And when he declared, "I am somebody," in a poem he often repeated, he sought to reach people of all colors. "I may be poor, but I am somebody. I may be young, but I am somebody. I may be on welfare, but I am somebody," Jackson intoned. It was a message he took literally and personally, having risen from obscurity in the segregated South to become America's best-known civil rights activist since King. Our father was a servant leader, not only to our family, but to the oppressed, the voiceless, and the overlooked around the world, the Jackson family said in a statement posted online. "We shared him with the world, and in return, the world became part of our extended family. His unwavering belief in justice, equality, and love uplifted millions, and we ask you to honor his memory by continuing the fight for the values he lived by." Despite profound health challenges in his final years, including a rare neurological disorder that affected his ability to move and speak, Jackson continued protesting against radical injustice into the era of Black Lives Matter. In 2024, he appeared at the Democratic National Convention in Chicago and at a city council meeting to show support for a resolution backing a ceasefire and the Israel-Hamas war. "Even if we win," he told marchers in Minneapolis before the officer whose knees kept George Floyd from breathing was convicted of murder, "it's relief, not victory. They're still killing our people. Stop the violence, save the children, keep hope alive." Jackson's voice, infused with the stirring cadence and powerful insistence of the black church, demanded attention. On the campaign trail and elsewhere, he used rhyming and slogans such as "hope not dope," and "if my mind can't conceive it and my heart can't believe it, then I can't achieve it," to deliver his message. Jackson had his share of critics, both within and outside of the black community. Some considered him a grandstander, too eager to seek out the spotlight. Looking back on his life and legacy, Jackson told the Associated Press in 2011 that he felt blessed to be able to continue the service of other leaders before him and to lay a foundation for those to come. "A part of our life's work was to tear down walls and build bridges. And in a half century of work, we basically torn down walls," Jackson said. "Sometimes when you tear down walls, you're scarred by falling debris, but your mission is to open up holes so others behind you can run through." In his final months, as he received 24-hour care, he lost his ability to speak, communicating with family and visitors by holding their hands and squeezing. "I get very emotional knowing that these speeches belong to the ages now," his son, Jesse Jackson Jr., told the AP in October. Jesse Lewis Jackson was born on October 8, 1941, in Greenville, South Carolina, the son of a high school student, Helen Burns, and Noah Lewis Robinson, a married man who lived next door. Jackson was later adopted by Charles Henry Jackson, who married his mother. Jackson was a star quarterback on the football team at Sterling High School in Greenville and accepted a football scholarship from the University of Illinois. But after he reportedly was told black people couldn't play quarterback, he transferred to North Carolina's A&T in Greensboro, where he became the first-string quarterback, an honor student in sociology and economics, and student body president. Arriving on the historical black campus in 1960, just months after students there launched sit-ins at a whites-only dinner, Jackson immersed himself in the blossoming civil rights movement. By 1965, he joined the Voting Rights March King led from Selma to Montgomery, Alabama. King dispatched him to Chicago to launch Operation Breadbasket, a Southern Christian leadership conference effort to pressure companies to hire black workers. Jackson called his time with King a phenomenal 4 year of work. Jackson was with King on April 4, 1968, when the civil rights leader was slain at a Lorraine Motel in Memphis, Tennessee. Jackson's account of the assassination was that King died in his arms. With his flair for the dramatic, Jackson wore a turtleneck he said was soaked by King's blood for 2 days, including at a King memorial service held by the Chicago City Council, where he said, "I come here with a heavy heart because on my chest is the stain of blood from Dr. King's head." However, several King's aides, including speechwriter Alfred Duckett, questioned whether Jackson could have gotten King's blood on his clothing. There are no images of Jackson in pictures taken shortly after the assassination. In 1971, Jackson broke with Southern Christian Leadership Conference to form Operation PUSH, originally named People United to Save Humanity. The organization, based on Chicago's South Side, declared a sweeping mission, from diversifying workforces to registering voters in communities of color nationwide. Using lawsuits and threats of boycotts, Jackson pressured top corporations to spend millions and publicly committed to diversifying their workforce. The constant campaigns often left his wife, Jacqueline Lavinia Brown, the college sweetheart he married in 1963, taking the lead in raising their 5 children. Santita Jackson, Yusef Du Bois Jackson, Jacqueline Levita Jackson Jr., and 2 future members of Congress, U.S. Representative Jonathan Luther Jackson and Jesse L. Jackson Jr., who resigned in 2012 but is seeking re-election in the 2026 midterm. The elder Jackson, who was ordained as a Baptist minister in 1968 and earned his Master of Divinity in 2000, also acknowledged fathering a child, Ashley Jackson, with one of his employees at Rainbow PUSH, Karen L. Stanford. He said he understood what it means to be born out of wedlock and supported her emotionally and financially. Despite once telling a black audience he would not run for president because white people are incapable of appreciating me, Jackson ran twice and did better than any black politician had before President Barack Obama, winning 13 primaries and caucuses for the Democratic nomination in 1988, 4 years after his first failed attempt. His successes left supporters chanting another Jackson slogan, "Keep hope alive." "I was able to run for the presidency twice and redefine what was possible. It raised the lid for women and other people of color," he told the AP. "Part of my job was to sow seeds of the possibilities." U.S. Representative John Lewis said during 1988 C-SPAN interview that Jackson, too, runs for the Democratic nomination, opened some doors that some minority persons will be able to walk through and become president. Jackson also pushed for cultural change, joining calls by NAACP members and other movement leaders in the late 1980s to identify black people in the United States as African Americans. "To be called African Americans has cultural integrity. It puts us in our proper historical context," Jackson said at the time. "Every ethnic group in this country has a reference to some base, some historical cultural base. African Americans have hit that level of cultural maturity." Jackson's words sometimes got him in trouble. In 1984, he apologized for what he thought were private comments to a reporter, calling New York City Hymetown, a derogatory reference to its large Jewish population. And in 2008, he made headlines when he complained that Obama was talking down to black people. In comments captured by a microphone he did not know was on during a break in a television taping. Still, when Jackson joined the jubilant crowd in Chicago's Grand Park to greet Obama that election night, he had tears streaming down his face. "I wish for a moment that Dr. King or slain civil rights leader Mega Evgas could just been there for 30 seconds to see the fruits of their labor," he told the AP years later. "I became overwhelmed. It was the joy in the journey." Jackson also had influence abroad, meeting world leaders and scoring diplomatic victories, including the release of Navy Lieutenant Robert Goodman from Syria in 1984, as well as the 1990 release of more than 700 foreign women and children held after Iraq's invasion of Kuwait. In 1999, he won the freedom of 3 Americans imprisoned by Yugoslavian President Slobodan Milosevic. In 2000, President Bill Clinton awarded Jackson the Presidential Medal of Freedom, the country's highest civilian honor. "Citizens have the right to do something or do nothing," Jackson said before heading to Syria. "We choose to do something." In 2021, Jackson joined the parents of Ahmed Arbery inside the Georgia courtroom where three white men were convicted of killing the young black jogger. In 2022, he hand-delivered a letter to the U.S. Attorney's Office in Chicago calling for federal charges against the former Chicago police officer Jason Van Dyke in the 2014 killing of black teenager Laquan McDonald. Jackson, who stepped down as president of Rainbow Push in July 2023, disclosed in 2017 that he had sought treatment for Parkinson, but he continued to make public appearances even as the disease made it more difficult for listeners to understand him. Earlier this year, doctors confirmed a diagnosis of progressive supranuclear palsy, a life-threatening neurological disorder. He was admitted to a hospital in November. During the coronavirus pandemic, he and his wife survived being hospitalized with COVID-19. Jackson was vaccinated early, urging black people in particular to get protected given their higher risk for bad outcomes. "It's America's unfinished business. We're free but not equal," Jackson told the AP. "There's a reality check that has been brought by the coronavirus that exposes the weakness and the opportunity." Mandami hires former Biden official to audit NYPD. A woman who worked in the Joe Biden administration has been selected by New York City Mayor Zohran Mandami to oversee an audit of six municipal agencies, including the New York Police Department, to determine if they uphold sanctuary laws, political reporting. The move is aimed at defending the city against President Donald Trump's immigration crackdowns and is part of an executive order Mandami signed earlier this month designed to strengthen the city's sanctuary laws. Mandami tapped Bedup Mostofi, who served as senior official at U.S. Citizenship and Immigration Services, for the audits as part of her new position as special advisor to the deputy mayor, two people told Political. "The directive is for folks to recommend to the mayor changes to policies and protocols that can be everything from process to accountability to transparency and so forth," Mostofi said. Mostofi said the tenure of former Mayor Eric Adams made her want to examine city's agencies, telling Political he undermined sanctuary laws. Under Adams, New York City's Department of Investigation found employees at the NYPD and the Department of Corrections, another department of Mostofi's auditing, violated sanctuary laws by sharing information with federal officials about immigration. Adams also sought to let Immigration and Customs Enforcement set up an office on Rikers Island, but it was blocked by the courts. New York sanctuary laws prohibit city employees from allowing ICE onto municipal properties like schools unless they have a judicial warrant for their arrest. Mostofi is also auditing the departments of probation, social services, and health, as well as the Administration for Children's Services, Political reported, since they most likely interact with federal immigration authorities. The Department of Homeland Security blasted Mandami's executive order, saying it will make New Yorkers less safe. "Mandami will make New Yorkers less safe as a direct result of this policy," Assistant Secretary Tricia McLaughlin said. "These are currently 7,113 criminal illegal aliens in the custody of a New York jurisdiction with an active detainer," she said. Secretary Kristi Noem and ICE leadership are urgently calling on Mandami to agree to release criminals in New York City's custody to ICE before they are released back onto the Big Apple streets to victimize and prey on more Americans, McLaughlin added. "When politicians bar local law enforcement from working with DHS, our law enforcement officers have to have a more visible presence so that they can find and apprehend the criminals let out of jail and back into the communities," she continued. "Once the audit reports are submitted, the mayor's office will then use the findings to enact new training protocols to strengthen sanctuary law compliances at each agency," Political reported. An official at one of the agencies being audited questioned what Mandami's motivations was. "This recent executive order only raises more questions as to what specific policies the administration is pursuing and what the expectations are for the employees responsible for enforcing it," the official told Political. Representative Chip Roy, Fourth Save Act vote. Representative Chip Roy, Republican for Texas, wrote U.S. senators to insist Majority Leader John Thune, Republican for South Dakota, can bring the Save America Act to a floor vote without abolishing the filibuster. In a letter sent Monday to senators and obtained by the Federalist, Roy laid out what he described as a straightforward way to force Senate action on the Safeguarding America Voter Eligibility Save America Act under existing Senate rules. The Save America Act would require documentary proof of U.S. citizenship to register to vote in federal elections and require voter identification to cast a ballot. The legislation passed the House 218-213 with one Democrat, Texas Republican Henry Krueller, voting with Republicans. But despite broad GOP support, the bill has stalled in the Senate. Roy noted in the letter that Thune has the power to put the bill on the floor any time, rejecting the argument that the only path forward would require weakening or nuking the filibuster. Roy's point centers on what he called the difference between a real filibuster and a fake or zombie filibuster. The commonly accepted 60-vote filibuster threshold to shut off debate is not the only way to force a vote in the Senate. The majority can force opposing senators to speak, Roy wrote, according to the Federalist. Under Senate rules, Roy explained, if a quorum is present, the Senate must either be voting or a senator must be speaking. If no one is speaking and a quorum remains, the Senate eventually proceeds to a vote. In practice, Roy said, Republicans often call up a bill, allow debate, then move to a 60-vote cloture vote to end the debate. When cloture fails, the Senate typically defaults into a quorum call rather than forcing the majority to continuously hold the floor through actual speaking. Roy argued Thune could instead keep the Senate in session and require Democrats to physically maintain a talking filibuster to delay the Save America Act while Republicans remain united and present. Roy said this would require discipline from Republicans, including tabling amendments and enforcing the Senate's two-speech rule to prevent endless stalling tactics. The push comes as Democrats intensify claims that the bill could disenfranchise certain voters, including married women whose legal names differ from those on birth certificates. Roy pushed back hard in an interview Monday on Newsmax, Rob Smith Tonight, saying the legislation was crafted with flexibility, including an affidavit option under penalty of perjury for voters with documentation issues. Roy also argued Democrats are deliberately misleading the public, contending they oppose common sense safeguards because they want non-citizens to vote. While non-citizen voting is already illegal, Roy and other supporters say the current system relies too heavy on the honor system, requiring applicants to simply check a box affirming citizenship. Supporters argue the Save America Act would provide meaningful enforcement and strengthen election integrity. In a related article, Trump rips the Democrat shutdown, pushes voter ID. As the U.S. faces the shutdown, slowdown over Department of Homeland Security funding and Congress battles over the Save America Act, President Donald Trump took aim at Democrats, vowing Republicans will stand firm on border security and election integrity. Trump made the remarks to reporters aboard Air Force One while returning to Washington on Monday. He accused Democrats of attempting to leverage DHS funding negotiations to extract concessions he said would undermine law enforcement and Immigration and Customs Enforcement, ICE. I don't like some of the things they're asking for, Trump said, referring to Democrat demands tied to DHS funding. We're going to protect law enforcement. We're going to protect ICE. He added, this is a Democrat shutdown. This has nothing to do with Republicans, he said. They're upset that the crime numbers are so good. The dispute is part of a broader clash over immigration enforcement. Democrats are attaching new demands to DHS funding that would curb the administration's wider crackdown on illegal immigration. The fight comes in the wake of last month's shooting deaths of two protesters in Minnesota, which have intensified debate in Washington over immigration policies. Trump also used the address to champion the Save America Act, focusing heavily on voter ID requirements and proof of citizenship in federal elections. Democrats are very unhappy. There's a movement to get voters' ID, Trump told reporters. The population, 98%, want voter ID. He accused Democrats of opposing voter ID laws for political reasons. They don't want voter ID because they want to cheat at elections, Trump has said. Trump argued that proof of citizenship is a central component of the legislation and claimed Democrats are resisting it. One of the things they're insisting on is proof of citizenship. And the Democrats don't want to give proof of citizenship. They don't want to give voter ID, he continued. The president went further, asserting that stricter election safeguards would fundamentally reshape the political landscape. They can never get elected if they ever change it. If you had voter ID, proof of citizenship, Democrats could never win an election. And they know that. They're fighting to the hilt, Trump said. Republicans have long argued that voter ID and citizenship verification measures are necessary to secure elections and restore public confidence in the electoral process. Democrats, meanwhile, have contended such measures risk disenfranchising eligible voters. Mark Kelly's attorney warns DOJ against second indictment. An attorney for Senator Mark Kelly, Democrat for Arizona, is warning the Department of Justice not to pursue a second indictment against his client, who, along with five other Democrat lawmakers, participated in a video urging military members to ignore, quote, illegal orders. In a letter to Attorney General Pam Bondi and U.S. Attorney for Washington, D.C., Jeanine Pirro, Kelly's attorney, Paul Fishman, wrote that a renewed effort to indict Kelly, as well as Senator Eliza Slotkin, Democrat from Michigan, and Representative Jason Crow, Democrat for Colorado, Chris DeLuzio, Democrat for Pennsylvania, Chrissy Houlihan, Democrat for Pennsylvania, and Maggie Goodland, a Democrat for New Hampshire, would be a remarkable abuse of power. There has never been any factual or legal basis for such an investigation or prosecution, Fishman wrote, according to NBC News, which reported Saturday that it reviewed a copy of the letter. Last week, a federal grand jury in Washington, D.C., declined to indict the lawmakers under a statute that carries a maximum 10-year prison sentence. The statute applies to anyone who advises, counsels, urges, or in any manner causes or attempts to cause insubordination, disloyalty, mutiny, or refusal of duties by any member of the military. It requires intent to interfere with, impair, or influence the loyalty, morality, or discipline of the military. Preet Bharara, an attorney for Slotkin, wrote a similar letter last week to Bondi and Pirro. According to NBC News, Bharara wrote that continuing to pursue this matter would violate clear ethical duties and Justice Department policies. The lawmakers, all of whom served in the military or intelligence community, participated in a 90-second video in November after President Donald Trump ordered the National Guard into U.S. cities to back his immigration enforcement efforts. In many cases, the deployments came over the objections of local leaders. At several points in the video, Kelly, Slotkin, DeLuzio repeated the line, "You can refuse illegal orders. You must refuse illegal orders." They never specified which orders were illegal. Goodlander joined Kelly in reminding viewers that, like us, you swore an oath to protect and defend the Constitution. Pressed on whether Trump had issued any unlawful orders to the military, Slotkin acknowledged she knew of no such orders. In a Truth Social post, Trump accused the Democrats of seditious behavior punishable by death. In a post on X, Vice President J.D. Vance wrote that if the president hasn't issued illegal orders, the members of Congress telling the military to defy the president is by definition illegal. Fishman's letter also cited a February 11th ruling by U.S. District Judge Richard Leon that blocked the Department of War from punishing Kelly, a former Navy pilot, for participating in the video. Leon granted a preliminary injunction, finding Kelly is likely to succeed on his claim that the department's actions were an unconstitutional retaliation for protected speech. The district court's reasoning applies with even greater force to the more severe punishment of criminal prosecution, Fishman wrote, according to NBC News. Because Senator Kelly's speech is protected by the First Amendment, it cannot be the basis for a criminal charge, and a grand jury properly instructed on the law could not conceivably conclude otherwise. Newsmax reached out to the department for clarification. Trump, Jesse Jackson was a good man. President Donald Trump on Tuesday offered his deepest sympathies and condolences to Jesse Jackson's family after news that the civil rights leader had died. In a statement posted on Truth Social, Trump said he had known the Reverend Jesse Jackson well, long before entering politics, and praised him as a good man with lots of personality, grit, and street smarts. "The Reverend Jesse Jackson is dead at 84. I knew him well, long before becoming president," Trump wrote. "He was a very gregarious, someone who truly loved people." Trump also used the moment to push back on years of criticism from Democrats and the media, saying he has been falsely and consistently called racist by what he described as scoundrels and lunatics on the radical left. Trump highlighted several instances in which he said he helped Jackson and causes Jackson supported, including providing office space for Jackson's Rainbow Coalition for years in the Trump Building at 40 Wall Street. The president also credited himself with supporting criminal justice reform and long-term funding for historical black colleges and universities, HBCUs, arguing that those initiatives were ignored by previous presidents. Single-handedly pushed and passed long-term funding for historical black colleges and universities, HBCUs, which Jesse loved, but also which other presidents would not do, Trump wrote. Trump said Jackson also supported opportunity zones, which he called the single most successful economic development package yet approved for black businessmen and women. Trump described Jackson as a force of nature like few others before him, and added that he was devoted to his family. "He loved his family greatly, and to them I send my deepest sympathies and condolences," Trump said. "Jesse will be missed." Jackson, a longtime civil rights activist and two-time Democratic presidential candidate, died Tuesday at age 84. His daughter, Santita Jackson, confirmed he died at home surrounded by family. A protege of the Reverend Martin Luther King Jr., Jackson became one of the nation's most prominent civil rights leader after King's assassination, building national influence through Operation Push and the Rainbow Push Coalition. Jackson spent decades advocating for voting rights, job opportunities, education, and health care, while also pressing major corporations to diversify in hiring and spending. In his final years, Jackson battled serious health issues, including a rare neurological disorder that affected his ability to move and speak. Still, he remained active in public life, continuing to appear at protests and political events. The Associated Press contributed to this report. Well, that's going to do it for me today, everyone. I hope you enjoyed today's reading. It's very sad about the Reverend Jesse Jackson. Have a great day. This has been Marian Kachuk with Talking Information Center. Listen to you next time.